Hi everybody, thanks so much for coming on a cold Friday night. My name is Katia Bukowska, I'm an artist and a founder of Feminist Legend. Feminist Legend is a very open platform that exists online as a kind of facilitator of this kind of events and online dialogue. So I'd like to thank first and foremost Bruce Hackworley Foundation University for inviting me back. About 6 months ago, I did a roundtable here. It was really interesting, so I'm back with a new subject, a new topic. And I'm going to dive right into this. So the subject tonight, which I felt... I perform a lot, so So the subject tonight is, we'll begin with basically, as you can imagine, with Gamergate, Anita Sarkeesian, I'm trying, and the threat that she experienced with recent Utah University quickly just forced to cancel a talk that would have taken place at Utah State University after the university received a terror threat from someone claiming they would commit the deadliest school shooting in American history. This is just a trigger, because when we were discussing this here, this is just a symptom of current climate, that not just this is gaming industry, which everyone claims is a men's world. We are living in a men's world, whatever we touch, art world, writing world, every world. And I feel as a woman with a voice doing anything, pretty much anything, you experience something, some kind of backlash. And I felt today it is an avalanche and it's getting ridiculous. So I just wanted to open it up. I just wanted to talk about this. And I'm not going to talk too much. I want my beautiful people, participants, to just dive right in into this, raise questions, ignite a conversation. And I'm going to introduce them one by one, quickly, and let them talk. So, to my right, I have, going to try really hard, Hafiza Jeter. She's a writer, and I will make a talk later. I'm sorry, not right here. I know. On my left, I have Jackie, maybe. I'm sorry, I'm doing the French, I don't know why.
Sounds better.
She's an independent curator and digital media consultant, and she works under Failed Projects.
That's the name, yeah.
That's the name, I love it. Anya Liftik, who's a performance artist. Benny Arcade, she's a performance artist, writer, poet, and experimental theater maker. And then I have Juliana Driver, who's a curator, writer, and educator. I have Emily Brandt, I'm sorry, I went, poet, teacher, and co-founding editor of No Dear magazine. And I have Leah Schrager, who's a visual artist. So, a variety. Anyone would like to go first, or I can nominate?
What's the subject?
I invited Penny for this. The subject, I can read it.
Okay.
Women's voices in the media, online, offline, talking, doing, breathing, leaving, doing anything. Abused, ignored, trolled, forgotten. That was a premise. What I ask now is, have you, everyone, experienced any abuse in your life, in your personal, in your professional, any backlash to you being publicly active? What have you experienced, and what do you think is happening today, and what is the future? Are we progressing, are we going backwards? What's happening? That's kind of broad.
First of all, you know, everybody has a mother, which creates a lot of problem in being a woman. Because the minute a woman speaks, everybody hears their mother telling them what to do. So it's really hard. Being a woman, I don't recommend it. If you can possibly avoid it. I mean, in my work, which I've been making my own work since 1984, my being outspoken has hurt my career. Mm-hmm. It hasn't hurt my relationship with the public. The public counts on me for that, but it definitely hurt my career. And I've always said that I never understood what it was in my expressing my opinion that makes people think I want them to agree with me. But that's a very, I don't know, that part of the problem is there's a lot of really stupid people in the world. And when you're dealing with stupid people, it's problematic. You know, when you're dealing with smart people, it's easy, right? You know, but people who are not conscious, you know, they don't know that they have these certain prejudices that they have. Like, I have a lot of prejudices, but I know I have them. At one point when I was in my late 30s, I was in analysis, and I was telling my analyst about the problems I was having in my career, where I was watching people whose work was a lot, I don't know what to say, not that it was not as good as mine, but it wasn't as good as mine, who were getting way ahead of me. Like, they were getting the gigs, they were doing the touring, they were getting the reviews. And I had these huge audiences, but I had none of that other kind of stuff, which is really what makes a career in the world we live in. And my therapist was very old, but I didn't know it because I was young. So I had no idea that she was, like, probably at that time in her middle 70s. And I ended up bringing Jeff Buckley. She became Jeff Buckley's therapist. She gave me an idea how wild this woman. She was very conservative. And she said to me, she goes, "Oh, Miss Ventura, you're surrounded by horrible people." And I said, "No, I'm just as horrible as they are. But I know I'm horrible." And a lot of people don't know they're horrible. So what? They don't know. They have no idea. And they slide through life, and then they get into their, like, 50s, and their lives are truly miserable. You know? I mean, to have a rigorous inquiry, not only as a human being, but as an artist, is essential. If you don't have that rigorous inquiry, you cannot develop authenticity. And if you don't have authenticity, you really don't have anything. But I think to answer your kind of bigger questions, we are going backwards. Mm-hmm. Look at the losses that women are experiencing regarding reproductive rights.
Yeah.
Look at how dumbed down the schools are. Look at a country that claims that it's a Christian country, but doesn't want to feed the poor. I mean, I just walked by 8 people sleeping on the sidewalk. You know, so we're living in an extremely confused environment. You know, so that's just what I'll say. Let other people talk.
Anyone else? Anna?
Wow, I'm like, that's.
Yeah.
It's a tough act.
That's what happens when you're old. Synthesis becomes incredibly easy.
I'm afraid what I'm going to say is going to sound completely shallow and self-centered after that. It's okay.
Not if you're speaking from yourself, how could it?
Well, what I did in response to your question was I just compiled a list of things that have been said on comments on things that I had done. I don't pretend that these make sense, mm-hmm. Or that they certainly, many of them are not intelligent, but I was just going to read to you as something of a very poor Dada experimental poem. The only thing you should know, other than that I don't understand a lot of what was being said myself, is that these are in response to the first part, which is a little bit clearer, is in response to Marina Abramović's Artist is Present. I did an intervention where I sat across from her dress like her, and it was on Gothamist. So that's right there is what you should know about that. I'm just going to read these. doubly pretentious and boring. Stupid idea, you suck, get over yourselves. This is awesome. I saw the artist as present 2 Fridays ago and wondered when she'd meet her match. The last guy I saw staring at her looked like his head was going to explode. Her stare is really that powerful. I would not be able to keep a straight face. It's easy when your mind is empty like these women. I'm going to take a dump on a plate and put it on a table. My art will make their art that much more interesting. Apparently, some guy tried to distract her a few times. He succeeded in making her laugh when he got down on a knee and proposed. Sometimes I watch people when they're sleeping. It's fascinating to see someone like that, barely moving, for hours. ha! I went to high school with Anya Liftig. She was nice and very smart, only a little weird. Apparently, she got way weirder. That one hurt. the art, on the other hand, is out sick. I don't understand it, so it's not art, or I understand it, but I don't like it, so it's not art. You choose. This is definitely a fair antiphon. The other artist is present could be cute, but it's also tough not to be a dick. Anyhow, artistic involvement with performance art is fair game. Also, if you feel the need to comment that it isn't art, you validate it as art. How do you figure that? If someone tells me he's going to read me a poem that reads me a grocery list, my impulse to comment that a grocery list isn't a poem does not validate it as art. Right, but if you go on the internet to discuss it in a forum debating its validity to art, well then, it has successfully elicited an emotional response. I prefer my performance art with naked chicks. See, that's the end of that interchange. Actually, in the past few weeks, I, of course, was Googling myself in a shallow and egotistical way, and discovered that a photograph of a piece that I had done where with a collaborator, Caitlin Berrigan, was where we were eating chocolate babies on the High Line, was being used by, I guess I would say that they're right-wing nut jobs, but they're so nut jobby that I can't even be sure that they're right-wing nut jobs. So this is a post from that. Right? Our little fiend could take a lesson from these scuzzy hippie chicks in Cambridge, followed by a picture of us. And then there's an excerpt from our description. Caitlin Berrigan and Anya Liftig often use food in their work as a driving force of desire and social allegory. In parentheses, gay and pretentious, !! then it follows, a month ago, the phenomenon is called moral relativism. Libs have it because they love evil. Baby Christians have it because they are invertebrates. Negatively, he, Dostoevsky, tried to show that if the existence of God is denied, then one is landed in complete moral relativism, which I can't say. So that, underlined, no act, regardless of how dreadful or heinous, can be condemned by the atheist or the baby Christian light. Name evil, you've got to be fucking kidding me, dude. Left is female, darkness and death. Right is male, light and life. Okay. Then there's another picture of it a little bit later on, and it says, artist info, succubus, Anya Liftig, right, is a graduate of Yale University. It goes on to say that there's a, you should refer to another thread called Satanic Feminism, which is on the same subject.
I'm on the napkin.
Satanic Feminism. That's a good one.
Yeah, it's really good.
Followed by a picture of Femin members. There's a sort of clip of Femin members doing their thing. And the same commenter says, all those topless women and not a decent rack in the bunch. They should treat those mosquito bites. Followed by, they're little girls. Emotionally, they want to screw like chinchillas with no consequences. Except they are so evil, selfish, and stupid, they don't realize that abortion is a leading cause of breast cancer. P.A.S. as well, post-abortion syndrome. And another person says,
oh my God.
I thought those were men, given how small they are. Thank goodness we have our libs on the home front to entertain, pray for, surrender to, join, and service the jihadists when the caliphate kicks off in earnest. Followed by a picture of a woman licking, probably a performance artist, licking some whipped cream and cherries off of a toilet seat. Again, our picture, clearly making sense. 3 women, 2 satanic, 1 good. I would guess that carpet-munching meat grinder Anya's heritage lies somewhere in the Nordic countries. No. Caitlin, on the other hand, hails from a pig farm. Then we've got Succubus. Anya Liftig is a graduate, such and such. At this point, when I saw this, I have to be full disclosure, I sent it to a couple of close people of mine and suggested that there should be some sort of retaliation and to troll back, which probably not the right way to handle the situation, although
it's deeply satisfying.
Deeply satisfying. So a person, Rugby One, who happens to be my father, said... light versus dark. You're on the way to being reported to Homeland Security. Don't push it. It's pretty much like my dad. You know? And then the person responds, Rugby One, LOL, the what zone? Boo, the first gay theist, Trooper Man, Freddie Nietzsche, the speed worker, Infinite Rage, the liberal superhero. And then another close person, my husband, writes, hey, light be dark, you're an idiot. Get something better to do with your time. Everyone you know feels sorry for your pathetic ass. They won't say it to your face, but they're all saying it behind your back. I thought that was kind of classy. In response, Nina, you really are a gay little tonic from England. Ha 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 ha. Dude, VP'd worker. Followed by a response to his response, wow, you really are an idiot. Do you even realize that your crappy little attempts at responses just make you look even more pathetic? Good luck with life, dude. You're going to need it. Can you borrow part of a brain from a friend or from someone? Clearly you're the victim of a botched lobotomy. Now go back in your little cave and talk to your puppet friends. I'm sure they understand the blubber rolling out of your mouth. We did that. Followed by the last two responses, which is, crazy shrieking little girls of both sexes, genders feel that everybody feels the way they do. And you know what? You do. Sorry, dude, who am I to judge? Peace, ghoul friend, you are awesome. Gay tattling little bullies, eat dog vomit as you like it, just saying, dude. The sad thing is, Cupcake, you might call yourself a Christian. You are basically refusing to judge anyone or anything because you are simply either are too cowardly to do so or you simply no longer care. So that's a little taste of that.
The first thing that comes to my mind is that has anybody ever seen comments that are bright? I mean, honestly, if you look at the comments, like even in the New Yorker, or it's almost like people who comment are like the stupidest people on earth. You know what I mean? It's never like you think like there's going to be these fantastic comments, and then you go and you, it's almost like, I don't know, it's like they convene there, you know? I mean, some of those comments, I must say, are priceless.
Chill. Yeah. Before we started with Marina, I just wanted to indicate that the artist was not only present, she was also myopic, and she wasn't wearing contacts. So part of her eternal stare at all and sundry was not in focus.
Well, I think it should have been called the art. Let's see. It should have been called The Artist Is There, because she certainly wasn't present.
I mean, now I'm mentioning that as one response to the...
It's okay, I'm just giving you my response.
Yeah,
but I think, you know, that one of the saddest, weirdest things is in this conversation a few weeks ago, and we were talking about how, you know, for commenters, for, like, the dudes on the worst, like, you know, sub-thread Reddits, the way that they, you know, it's my guess that the way that they build community is through being awful. Mm-hmm. You know, part of the reason that they, like, up their game of these, like, insane comments is to show their friends.
Yeah, but I don't even think they really have community. I think it's the exact opposite. I think it's loner creatures who are, like, jerking off in front of the computer and then every once in a while, like, land somewhere where they can leave a comment. I don't think that there's some community that they're building. I mean, they may have another friend who's also another shut-in, you know, who's commenting, but largely, I don't experience it as... I think people are much more isolated than we're aware of, you know? Especially people like this. I mean, some of this stuff is, like, so... I don't know, it's subnormal, you know? I mean, that's my personal opinion about it. Having seen so many of, you know, like a couple of years ago, I did 48 performances of my Sex and Censorship show, Bitch, Dyke, Fag, Hag, Whore in London, which I performed. It started at PS 122 in 1990 and then went off Broadway for a year. And then I toured it for 3 years around as a mainstream commercial hit around the world. And then I retired it. And then people wanted me to bring it back. So I brought it back and did it in London. We did 48 shows. And somebody came to review it from The Guardian, who was like some cheesy 30-year-old male, straight male performance artist. And he said, he was clearly coming to like shoot me down, you know. And anyways, what ended up happening was there was this incredible response online to his review, you know, mainly from people who had been at the show. And then I was like really kind of stunned to actually see, like, I mean, there were some incredibly smart things that people were saying that were, like, you know, among the best reviews, not meaning that they, because they loved it, but because they were so thoughtful in what they had to say. And for me, the role of the critic is that the critic should be also telling the artist something that the artist doesn't know about the work. You know, it's not just that they're there to say, ooh, this is so good, and ooh, that really sucks, you know. But generally, I've been stunned by, you know, you'll have an incredibly intelligent piece or something, and then you look at the comments and you can't believe what the people are writing. They have nothing to do with anything. It has nothing, obviously, to do, really. I mean, there wasn't any salient criticism of what you were doing. No, but I mean, you have to take that into consideration. You have to say, like, you know, did 75 people who saw the piece write in about it? No, not one of those people saw the piece. They're commenting on a commentary about it, that it existed. So, you know, I don't know if it's how useful it is to think that that's real in any way. Anyways, zip.
I'm Emily Grant, and I'm a poet and a teacher and an editor, and I'm not going to talk about comment sections. I think one thing that I was thinking a little bit about before coming here that might be a slightly different angle is the idea that Bell Hooks always talks about, that patriarchy doesn't have a gender.
Thank you.
And, you know, I think that I feel like I kind of, a lot of us, I'm sure, myself included, exist in kind of liminal way, because we all kind of exist in liminal spaces. And for me, I think some of those spaces include being a poet, where I do feel like I've got a foot in the art world, but I also feel like poetry is so fringe and sort of outside of capitalism, and there's no, like, poetry galleries and stuff. So it's a little bit like one foot in, one foot out. I feel like, I mean, I work in the public school system. I'm a teacher leader / instructional coach / painting. I'm like on a very small, often awkward, often lonely island between administration and other teachers. So there's like that conversation with every day. And then obviously as a white woman, every day I have oppression and privilege. So I think that when I think about this idea that patriarchy doesn't have a gender, and that I have some access to patriarchy because I grew up middle class, because of my skin color, because I have degrees from Boston University and New York University and all of this, I think about what do I really want as an artist? Do I want to attain some of that power in the patriarchal system? Or I'd like to say I want to challenge that system. What does that even mean? How do you challenge a system from inside of it? Or am I like content to exist on the fringe of that system? So I think it's a question that I don't think that most straight white male artists have to ask themselves that question, but I think pretty much every other artist does have to kind of ask that question, and it's something I'm grappling with a little bit now as I'm emerging. Like, I have out some chapbooks, some in journals, but I don't yet have my first book published. And I think one thing that I noticed is that when I write about a lot of different content and different styles as well, but for a long time I was reading columns that were about my dad and about the Vietnam War. And that appealed to like a very mainstream audience. And when I would read at readings, pretty much everybody, maybe except for some more like experimental artists, were like, that's boring, it's about her dad. But pretty much everybody else was like, wow, those are amazing. And particularly men would come up to me and have these like super long conversations, and they really felt connected to that. And I would get comments too, like, because they also are, the poems had a lot to do with airplanes and a lot to do with mechanics and engineering, and so I would also get to like, and how do you know so much for a girl? Comments from like older Vietnam era guys, and that was interesting. And then my most recent chapbook is called Man World, and it's very like the content is very heavy feminist explicit commentary, and like obviously there's audiences that love that, but like. When I read 2 weeks ago for a fairly mainstream, like, tourist audience, Bari Poetry Club, just, like, looking around, it's like, a third of you are really with me, and two-thirds of you are like, what? And then the other thing I noticed is that when people would talk to me after the reading, particularly men, if they said anything, they'd be like, oh, yeah, those were great, it was really, like, funny and interesting, and then that would be it, as opposed to previously for other content, people would like go on and talk about it and try to connect, and I felt like, so rather than opening a conversation, I felt like it was kind of closing a conversation, that people didn't know what to say. They just didn't know what to say. And I thought that was really interesting. And so I think, because Hafiza and I were talking about how people don't hear enough poetry, and when I read one poem from Man World, you kind of get the sense of what is going on. And the artwork in this chapbook is by Katya. So there are stills from her performances, and they're awesome. So I'm just going to read one poem that kind of like expresses somewhat of how I feel. And it's called A Man's World Is Not Just a Saying. Maybe there's nothing to be afraid of. A tiny drink might do the trick, but everywhere I go, I'm in a building, and every building was made by man, even the sidewalk, even the view. My room would be different if I could. There'd be no corners and a lot more light, less wall, more cloth. I saw someone knit a kitchen once. It still looked like a man. The fire belongs in the middle, and everyone gathers around, plates full and knives sharp. The buildings are so tall they hurt. Woman didn't build the London Bridge that she made fall 1,000 times. When I ask Siri where I can get an abortion, he tells me there are no abortion clinics in New York City, and disguises his voice as a lady. But when I ask Siri where to get my cocks up, she lists escort services I never knew existed in my house. Batter my heart, Siri, I never saw a man swoon so hard as for your trinkets. I'd like to be a programmer and create the next world. First off, there'd be animals everywhere, non-human, and we would call them deer and hold hands a little in the evenings. And never ever suck their milk or swipe their eggs. Just lay back and look at nudie mags of the farmer in the dell. No, none of that. Just light a fire. And so, yeah, when I read poems like that that are not about my dad in the Vietnam War, it's kind of like, or on the reverse, and this is like another topic maybe for more dialogue later, they're like, yeah, it's good, but like there's so much content.
So much
content? So much content.
Yeah.
There's a message. That's a whole, there's a whole, that's like a whole other, what do you call that? Like a euphemism, right? Yeah, or like it is not. Written by patriarchy.
I want to add a footnote about patriarchy and the use of straight white man.
Yeah, it's not the same thing.
Yeah. It's not 1970.
Yeah, no,
it's true. I'm not saying this to you, I'm saying it to the room. You know, I just find that people seem to be able to use straight white man as a put down when there's like a whole bunch of straight white men in this room who are not straight white men, A. People use the word straight from, like, you know, I'm pretty much, well, I don't know if I am anymore or not, but I'm pretty much identified with the queer world, that small Q, not the big Q, right? Small Q. And, you know, I have a lot of friends who are in their 20s and 30s and 40s. I'm in my 60s, right? And I have to hear them throw around the word straight as a put down all the time. They don't have any problem with that. If somebody were to use the word, if you use the word trans in a sentence, you're going to get attacked by everybody, you know. But there seems to be an alacrity, you know, and that people act like it's 1970. A straight white male in 2014 is not what a straight white male was in 1970. Believe me, I was there, you know, and there's been, and I myself had to really kind of walk through the fire with that, shut the fuck up! I had to walk through that in the early 90s, because the person who is now my long-term collaborator, Steve Zettner, is a white straight guy from Iowa, and he was tenderized by going to university in the 80s, you know, where a lot of his friends were lesbians, lesbian feminists. I had to kick that shit out of him because he had all that 80s, you know, lesbian feminist shit going on. Was really pretty narrow-minded, you know, but through him. You know, I had to, because most of my friends were gay. I'd like pull a heterosexual out of the swim pool every once in a while. You know, but I was, my world was not a heterosexual, you know, social blah, 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 right? But through him, I had to really, and it was hard for me because I was very invested in this idea that, you know, even though it wasn't about the patriarchy, I mean, I'm not a bell hooks reader. I'm really glad you said that quote. But in my show Bad Reputation, which I did in 1997, I said, you know, the patriarchy is made up of men and women. And worse so, it's women. Like, my show Bad Reputation was about the failure of feminism, how women betray women. And it's the one thing that feminists will never talk about. And it is the biggest, for me, the biggest issue. I did a show in 2002 called New York Values, and it was reviewed by this woman, Alexis Solosky, who, of course, now used to be at the Village Voice. Now she's at the Times and at the Guardian, because apparently shit floats. And she wrote this review of me that was so... You would have thought it was written by a really anti-feminist person. And there's Stephen Bottoms from the UK who wrote the essay, the big essay on my work and the hardcover book on my work, really called her out for her anti-feminist attack on me. She actually said, I was 52 then, and she said, even at 52, Penny Arcade is still devastatingly sexy. Too bad her tired work hasn't aged as well as her rack.
Oh.
And that was a woman, okay? You know, that was a woman, you know? So, I just want to put that out, yeah. And particularly for all the men who are here, who are feminists, who, you know, support their women friends, you know, I just want to put that out. And this is not against you in any way.
Yeah,
I felt it just needed to be said. I needed to say. So thanks.
No, thank you. I think that's really right on.
I know someone who experienced
water. Yeah, definitely. Yes, women are some of my biggest critics. So I just wrote a little bit because that's easier for me, so I'm going to read it. I'm a New York-based artist, visual and social practice artist, In my art practice, it's important to me that I use myself, so my own body's on the line, to face challenges and to work through and react to them. In 2010, I founded a field of therapy called Naked Therapy under the name Sarah White. Naked therapy is a form of talk therapy during which the client and our therapist becomes naked, and that nakedness is used to facilitate unique client insights, and it's done by webcam. Today, I'm going to talk about some experiences I've had as the public figure of Sarah White from the media, online, and in real life. First, the press. Naked therapy was proposed on the web in 2010, and after some early successes and due to a story in the Daily, it hit all the major news outlets, like the New York Daily News, Jay Leno, Fox, CBS, NBC, etc. The press has always been a mixed blessing. On one hand, it was essential for me to reach a democratic audience, and by this I mean an audience outside of the art world audience. And since the work is based in interaction, participation is essential to the development of the practice. So it's valuable in spreading the word, gaining participants, and frankly, gaining traffic and income, which all led to further development of the naked therapy theory. But what I learned early on is that I have to have a loose hold on my representation in media. The number of inaccuracies and misstatements are mind-boggling. For journalists, it's often just lazy journalism or intentional sensationalism. For commenters, it can be downright lies and intentionally aggressive spreading of misinformation. Just plain meanness, positiveness, and more. Here are just a few quotes. Another whore making money taking her clothes off. This woman should get the Nobel Peace Prize. This is just another example of women using sexuality and bodies to make a buck, and when these guys eventually realize they're being used, they will hate women more than they do now. And this is from a psychiatrist. I would like to speak out in support of naked therapy as a new and exciting form of talk therapy. So I have a client in common, and while I worked with him for over 5 years, various cocktails of prescriptions and therapy methods, he has made significant improvements with her over the course of a few sessions, and the improvements have continued over the past couple months. And there's an article right now in Psychology Today that has a really interesting conversation going with both actually like negative and positive and some really thoughtful comments. And I should add, I've also had some very thoughtful press as well as the more sensational press.
Are you trained as a therapist?
No. No. No, therapy is not a regulated term.
No,
so
no,
it's
I understand
not,
that.
Yeah. So I'd like to talk about two instances I think are relevant to women today. One in real life and one online. The first is in regard to the online risk of essentially girlfriend revenge, which I'll define in a minute. When I decided to take on the name Sarah White in 2010, it was a very practical decision. I was running a performance space out of my home and was worried about the safety implications of broadcasting myself on the web. As I propagated Sarah White's image from 2010, I erased Leah Schrager's image in my Google Part 1 project. And I did this through removing my image from Google search results. And I did that out of safety concerns as I was receiving death threats by email and the desire for there to be no link online. And and this desire changed an obsession for me. So my other art projects at this time also feature an obscured face. And then in 2013, my dad sent me an email saying that he was so sorry, but he's found a linking of Leah Schrager and Sarah White online. And it's in the first page of my Google search results. And I was devastated. The commenter's name was DirtyLove4812. And he said on the video Sarah White on YouTube, "Bullshit, her name is Leah Schrager, and this is all an act to get paid to strip." I consider this to be a subset of girlfriend revenge. So girlfriend revenge is when a guy can get revenge on his ex-girlfriend by submitting a naked photo of her to a website. Particularly nasty cases of this will involve the girl's full name and her home address. There are a lot of similar elements in this, I think, to the nude photo leak, and it happens to celebrities we know and to normal people. I had not asked for it, and there was no way I could get it down, even though I tried numerous times, but YouTube would not remove it. So when I realized I couldn't remove it, I entered the Google Project Part 2, Multiplication, and in this, I propagated false images of myself to try to create a Google flood so that there was so much information that no one could ever know what was true or false. I turned photographs into digital art objects and deleted the kind of art I did by posting myself as a collective that does various kinds of art. But despite my efforts, the girlfriend revenge tag raced to the front page of my Google search results, forced to be possessed. I still don't know who did it, and as we all know, the online world is particularly lawless in this way and open for acts of trolling and anonymous acts of aggression. The next event I'd like to briefly touch on is the challenge that a woman faces when she uses a sexually and potentially commercial images of herself. So the example I have is that in 2013, I applied to an open call to take part in the West Chelsea Artist Open Studios, and I was accepted by the organizer as a participant. When I submitted my feature image, he kicked me out of the Open Studio. The image had a URL on it. The director said that my work was an ad and not art, and that I was a commercial entity and not an artist. And to me, this seemed very unfair. It felt like a targeted move against women who use the performative body provocatively, particularly with commercial potential. I, of course, think it's very important that artists are paid for the art, but apparently, since I was a young female, that made me commercial. This is, in my humble opinion, a prejudice in the art world that I am still trying to work through. After my first year of my MFA program, which was last year, I came to understand that it was important for me to share all my works with them to each other, and I've entered sort of part three of my Google project, which I call Conflation. So I have a number of other online projects, and they're all linked under the same umbrella at ownartist.com. I'm very interested in the potential of multiplicity online, which I see as a particularly feminine characteristic. I've started using the phrase Ona to describe my online personas, and I'm also on the verge of publishing an article about the Ona generation. An Ona is a virtual profile presence through which a person seeks to share, sell, or hook up online. And each person can have one or many Onas, and they may operate in concert or separately, depending on a person's goals. So to put it another way, the Ona gen doesn't have alter egos, they have multi-egos, aka Onas. And it's the virtual action of these Onas that gives the Ona gen its unique qualities. So I think there's a lot of positive potential and obviously a lot of negative potential in this.
I have a few questions for you about this, because I'll work my way backwards, and I'm not sure if I grokked every single thing that you said the first time in hearing it. When you said about this gallery not wanting to accept you because your presentation included a URL, and you feel that this was probably because of the nature of your work and that you used your body, etc. And it seems to me that every other artist in the show would also want to have a link to their URL so that they could sell something too, you know. The other thing that kind of concerns me a little bit is the shrink who wrote to you and said that you had done this great work with his client who was not well, you know, like that's a very weird relationship, you know, therapeutic relationship is like a really dicey relationship. I mean, in the 90s, a lot of shrinks used to send their patients to see my work, you know, and it was kind of weird, you know. I mean, I understand why they did it because I'm very real and I talk about myself in a very exposing way about my own psychology, etc., so people, you know, could come and I could understand why shrinks would send them. But that's way different from me doing therapy with people. I worry about you a little bit, and I also worry about them, and I especially worry about the shrink who thinks that it's a good idea to send a troubled person to an artist for therapy. So I want to say that, and what else do I want to say? That's all I want to say. But yeah. I think there's probably a lot more to talk about with what you're saying. I mean, as somebody who's, you know, I'm known for being nude on stage, even though I've only done two shows where I'm nude. You know, you do a show where you're nude, you become an expert on nudity. But I have gotten very little attacks on the basis of that, because in Bitch Dyke Fag Hag Whore, I'm nude for about 20 minutes. And I remember when I was doing the show, we did it off-Broadway for a year at the Village Gate, and all these Hasids would show up, right? And they'd come, you know, because the dancers, Bitch Dyke Fag Hag Whore kick-started the international burlesque movement. It was the first show that had erotic dancers in it. And so they would dance for an hour while the audience was coming in. And a lot of men would come, Hasids included, who thought that this was like a sex thing, you know. And they'd come in and they'd, like, you know, just pull their chair right up to the dancer like that. And then they'd have to hear me talk about my mother, and they would come up to me and complain.
because I was ruining their sex high, you know. But in being nude, like a big premise of my work, and I think you and I might agree in this area, is that I don't believe that sensationalism and content can coexist. As soon as there's content, there's no sensationalism, you know. And when I'm nude in Bitch, Dyke, Fag, Hag, Whore, I'm talking about real things. I'm talking about feminism. I'm talking about family. I'm talking about politics, blah, blah, blah. And the last line is always, well, I guess by now you probably forgot I have my clothes off, blackout, proving that the audience has long stopped looking at my naked body, because naked bodies are not that interesting after 2 minutes. I mean, you scan, you look, you've seen it, and then you're not interested anymore. As opposed to if somebody's scantily dressed, it can be eked out for a lot longer. So I just think it's interesting hearing you with that, and the fact that I've gotten the only problems I've had with being nude on stage or being sexually explicit, because I'm sexually explicit in other shows of mine where I talk about rape and rapes that happened to me, not just making up rapes and stuff, has come from white-collar feminists. Like, they were my biggest enemy through my whole career, have been white-collar feminists.
Why do you think that happens in the same... I know you've had backlash from feminists. Why do you think that?
Because people don't, I mean, I don't know, people are so miserable. When I was in Vienna, when I tour, I like to hire people locally. Because I don't like going in there as the New York artist who's so cool and you people suck, and you're, you know. So I like to hire local people. And when we were in Vienna, I hired, through the Vienna Festival, I hired all these Eastern Europe, this is, we're talking 1994, all these Eastern European strippers, and a committee of Viennese, if you can imagine, Viennese feminists came and complained to me that I was hiring these women who had pimps and who were, you know, perhaps involved in white slavery, and, you know, they demanded that I stop working with them immediately. And I was like, does this make any sense? Like, you want these women who are working in a feminist show about freedom, you want them to go, you know, to not have this experience, you know? So a lot of it has to do with these shared agendas. Like, one of the fundamental issues that I find is that, you know, hate mongers have absolutely no trouble forming coalition, you know? Like, in what you've read or, you know, what you're saying, like, you know, you can get, like, you know, white feminists, and then you can get, like, demented, born-again Christian hate mongers and people who don't have anything else in common, you know, when they want to share an agenda of hatred, very, very easily come together. But we who consider ourselves freedom lovers, we're very, like, uneasy about forming coalitions, you know? So it's kind of staggering. Do you understand what I mean when I'm talking about that? Everything is, like, so broken down into little different identity groups, and, you know, everybody's with their own little scene. Meanwhile, we have these huge enemies that are out there in the world right now that are not just threatening our art practice. Who gives a fuck, you know? If your art practice can get threatened, stop doing it, you know what I mean? But are actually threatening our very lives and our and the way we're moving forward in the world, you know? And people don't seem to take it very seriously. You know, there seems to be, I don't know how people can not take what's going on right now in this country, not take it seriously, that there is tremendous threat, and that the fact that we are unable to come together, you know,
as supposedly intelligent, creative, artistic, blah, blah, blah people, and not know that we should be forming a wedge, you know, to fight this stuff is really disturbing to me.
Is it possible to get an idea of the structure of this discussion?
There isn't any.
What do you mean?
Do you want to know when you can talk?
No, I would just like an idea of who's talking and when and a context for what they're saying.
I'm talking whenever I want.
You could ask questions any time.
Okay, why is there a fucking 15-minute treatise on, like, what a straight white male is and the term white feminist is just used blankly?
Well, I'm just using that. I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be a white, a 15-minute treatise on what, 15 minutes? Like, well, I thought it was about 4 minutes, you know what I mean? But I'm saying that there, my, you know, I have been oppressed by the matriarchy, okay? And most of those women were white. Some of them sometimes are black. That's happened to me, too. But I just thought, I think I was doing not an alliteration. I didn't go to college, so I don't know what word you use. Like, white male, and then I decided to say white feminist. You
Wait,
know?
We're still not talking about how we're talking.
Oh, my God.
So
I don't
what,
know.
So who is the next person? Has everybody on the panel?
So no, we have one more person to speak.
We have three more.
Yay.
Yeah.
All right.
No, I know, but it's just such a young thing to do.
So I have some notes. I have a lot of things I want to share with you. I don't have a really great memory, so
why don't you start telling us about who you are?
All right. So I'm a curator. I'm Juliana. I'm a curator and a writer and an educator. I teach at the City College of New York, which is part of the CUNY system. I also work at Columbia in the Arts Administration Program as an administrator. And I've been doing that for the past 10 years or so. I've also done a lot of work in public space, which maybe contextualizes me a little bit as a woman who does something in public, most recently with Katya, in fact. And tonight I'm going to do something a little different. I don't normally do this, but I'm going to get personal. And I'm going to talk to you about my identity as a mom. I'm a mom to the coolest 6-year-old boy named Jack. And as someone who's been really active in the art world, I feel like for a lot of reasons I've had to hide my parental status as a mom. It's not something that I really wanted to talk about very much, and I feel like letting others know that I'm a mom has kind of been perceived as a liability, something that could hurt me professionally, make me seem weak or unavailable to do things, less willing to take risks. Or even worse, like as someone who's extremely vanilla and suburban and soft. And also that, like, you know, if I'm ever in casual conversation with someone, I could sort of feel like people clench up like, oh, are you going to foist your Etsy-inspired Instagram feed on me with, like, all this cute shit that your kid is doing or something? And I don't do that. that kind of mom. And I feel like on the flip side, dads are seen as responsible and the sort of bearers of a large financial burden and the breadwinners, and it's kind of it's a good thing for them. It's good to be seen as a dad. And so, you know, I think as I've slid further into parenthood, I've felt these things more and more, and so tonight I kind of wanted to strike a threat on behalf of all moms to kind of call bullshit on these biases, just kind of say that, like, I am sick of mom as being a demeaning characterization And I want to kind of take it back, like slut and bitch and whore. I want to take that word back and make it a positive thing. So when I first had my son, I was completely overwhelmed. I'd never changed a diaper in my life. I had no idea how to take care of a child. It was something that was not planned for me. And I was really anxious about what this new role of mom meant to me as a woman and as a feminist. And I think it was really exacerbated by the fact that I didn't have any role models. Like the girl who was at a punk rock show and could look at the girl on stage who's playing guitar and think like, oh yeah, I can do that too. Like I didn't have anyone in my life. All of my mentors and the women who I really looked up to were childless by choice. They didn't want to have kids, and so I didn't really have anyone to look to kind of give me a standard. But I think over the past 6 years, there's been this process of, like a really slow process of self-actualization, which, like I kind of made a shift from the work that I had been doing previously, which was sort of more, I really wanted to be mainstream, and I think I felt really bad in a way that, like, I couldn't be. I think that there were, I felt like I was not welcome in that arena because of my background. I'm the first person in my family to go to college. You know, I don't come from a pedigreed family, and I felt like I had a really hard time figuring out where I fit into all of that. And so with having a kid and having to kind of like making the decision to really kind of take a step back for a second and try to figure out the shitstorm of change that was happening around me, I made this transition into doing work that was decidedly less mainstream and more community-based. And I feel really lucky that I found my way into some really incredible communities of people who supported my work, made it possible for me to find a new footing and find new confidence. And it was reaffirming. I felt like I could be a mom and I could take risks and I could do bold things and I could feel successful and I could feel multidimensional. But, I mean, there were bad days too. I remember when my son was 8 months old, I went to a party at the house of a good friend of mine, and we were having a conversation, and she asked me, you know, what I used to do, and I said, well, you know, I'm still a curator, and I'm still a cultural worker, and I'm still doing things, and her response, her very snide response was, you know, oh, right now, but you're just curating your son's little outfits every day. Oh. And
it's like your friend?
So, no, not my friend. Obviously not my friend. I was mortified and so, so angry, and I felt really betrayed. I felt really betrayed that there was this woman, this young woman, who really was not much younger than I was at the time, you know, betraying me. And, like, really contributing towards this systematic inequality that was keeping our gender as second-class citizens. There was also a job interview I had once where I was being interviewed by these two women at a Chelsea gallery, and one of them asked me, also couldn't have been too much younger than I was at the time, you know, do you think I had this policy of not discussing my parental status in job interviews, and with this one particular opportunity, I thought, you know, I'm going to play it fast and loose, and I'm just going to see where the chips fall, and I talked about it, and I talked about taking a step back for a second, and one of them asked me, well, you know, this is a really high-demand job. Do you think that you would be able to do this, like, as a mom, you think you'd be able to take on this amount of responsibility? And my response was, well, my husband does it every day. Like, why wouldn't I be able to do it? And P.S. and by the way, I didn't get the job. And there was another good friend of mine who, when she found out she was pregnant, and she waited the standard 3 months before letting her employer know that she was expecting, her employer's response was to completely restructure the organization and make her position part-time and make it impossible for her to stay on. So she was effectively pushed out of her position. And I think that in all of this, there's a huge empathy gap between people with kids and people without kids. And I don't know, I think we need to fill it, and I don't know how we fill it. And beyond social interactions, bringing it back to the media surface part of the conversation, I've also been thinking about these things as they come up in the news, and it was like nails on a chalkboard when I was reading about Ken Johnson's review of Michelle Grabner's solo exhibition at James Cohen Gallery recently, when he called her art bland. And set it in direct equation to her status as a middle-class tenured professor and soccer mom. Right, so soccer mom, bland. And there were lots of responses to this piece, and he was rightly called a sexist and a lazy critic who kind of lacked the understanding of the breadth of Grabner's practice and the obvious transference of her art into her life, and which happened to include children. And I'm also not sure if Grabner herself made a public statement about that. I don't always pay attention to these things, but I feel like I would have wanted to see that. I feel like a lot of people showed up in support of her, but I really would have supported her if she said something. And now, at
she
the
did.
End of this... Did she? Did she? Oh, okay.
And she didn't seem to be... Yeah, I saw something on Facebook.
Oh,
yeah, and she didn't seem to be fazed by Ken's review and her statements at all.
Huh. But now I'm sort of left wondering what the next steps are, and how can we make the art world and the world in general more inclusive of families and welcoming of families, and how do we do it? What would it look like? And you know, who else would get to participate as a consequence? You know, like, maybe there would be some more diverse audiences. Maybe people would actually start showing up to museum shows if there were spaces for families to convene, spaces for mothers to breastfeed, things that were just sort of made more available to this, you know, wider audience of people.
Thank you.
Very much.
Thank you.
Everyone, I'm Pathisa. Before I start, did we get to your question?
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to make sure.
Yeah.
Put that in verse. So, like Emily, I'm a poet, which is kind of like a very fascinating space because this is the tiniest art form that exists, I think, other than like what your friend is doing that no one knows about. And so we exist in this very tiny art form, and for me, it's a very white space, and it's also a very male space. And so, obviously, you can see I'm black. surprise. And so, which is very interesting, because in so many ways, like, my blackness is this object in the poetry world, where people interact with me in three ways. Like, I'm magical. I'm this curiosity, or it's something to be fearfully cautious of. And I know we're supposed to be telling our own personal stories, but I don't think I read the email right. So I'd like to talk about this through like something that actually happened, that's actually currently happening, ironically, on Facebook. So I don't know how familiar y'all are with poetry, but there's this thing called the, you know, the National Book Award is for fiction, poetry, children's book. And this year, this woman named Louise Glick won, and everyone was kind of upset. Not because she's not a great poet, but there's this poet, Claudia Rankine, and she wrote this book, Citizen. And this, like, to compare it to something else in pop culture, this is like the scandal of books. Like, this is the thing that everybody's talking about, white, black, no matter what. Like, everybody, Asian, this is the book. And just to give you a quick overview, it's a book about, easiest way to say it's about microaggressions, but the way Claudia Rankine describes it is about the intimacy that's disrupted between two people when the imagined violence of race enters a relationship. And so this, we've been talking, everyone has been talking about this book for months. And so it didn't win, and when you're upset, you go to Facebook, you make a status. And so then there's this white guy, and he runs one of the most important poetry presses out there, it's called Wave Books. And he posts this really weird status that says, "Let the parade of white poets complaining Glick won one who would have been thrilled to have their own book win over Rankine began." And so, like, everyone was kind of like, what does that mean? Like, it's, like, it's just like a weird statement. It's very confusing. And so these are all the comments. There are 26 pages as of when I left work today. I printed this at 5. It's still going. So, like, you know, poets, yeah. And so everyone's just like, you know, what are you talking about? And he says, which is, like, the best part about this, and this is page 1, "I haven't had a chance to read Citizen yet, or the Glick book. I can imagine they might very well be equally deserving for different reasons, as other books would be as well. It's so hard for people to believe. I mean, it's just a stupid award. The mostly white clamor about the amazingness of Citizen is frankly suspicious to me. It feels like, once again, taking something away for other purposes, a kind of bragging about righteous reading, appropriation that takes away from whatever the book is actually doing as poetry, which is probably a lot." So the first problem is that the mostly white clamor, which tells us everything we need to know about his friend list, because, like, a lot of black people are talking about this, too. So that was confusing. And then people are just, like, you know, are slowly, like, calling him on the shit. Like, in the nicest way possible. And then he goes on to say, "I'm sure Citizen is a worthy book. As I said, I haven't had a chance to read it yet. We have a newborn. I'm also sure there are a lot of people, white and otherwise, who generally love the book. And I'm also 1,000% sure that a big part of this phenomena of everyone being excited about the same book is white people bragging like crazy about how much they like it in order to feel slash look better. Those phenomena, good book, white bragging, are not mutually exclusive." So, I mean, it just continues where, like, people are just like, what the fuck is happening, you know? Who is this, like, guy? But, like, everyone knows who this guy is. And so, like, everyone's really giving the benefit of the doubt. And they're having this conversation with them, like, everyone is sincerely trying to help. They're just like, surely, like, he didn't mean this. And then, like, he goes on to say that, like, people are getting really close to calling me racist. And, like, when he says that, everyone, like, you gotta take a moment and just, like, he's actually the closest that anyone has got to calling him racist. But, like, he knows that there's an issue. And the fact that, like, you know, to your point about, like, you know, families, he throws up the fact that he has a kid, like, is a reason he gets to overtly speak about this issue. And it's just like, okay, like, only a man could use that excuse of, like, I had a baby, I don't have to, like, be informed anymore. But I think my point in bringing this up is that, like, this goes on for 26 pages so far of him just being like, you guys don't get me, versus, like, him just stopping to be like, whoa, a lot of people just got upset, what did I say? And I think one of the issues is that, like, he takes this attack on two women, neither who asked for his help, neither whose book he's read, and he pits them against each other. Now, the woman who won, Louise Glick, taught the woman that everyone's upset didn't win, Claudia Rankine. So he creates this, like this hostile relationship between them that doesn't exist in this public sphere. And he, what he doesn't understand is the implication, what he's saying is that, like, he can't possibly fathom that all these white, that this black woman could have written this book that so many white people identify with. That's the underlying issue of why he knows he's getting a little bit racist, but he won't actually address it. And so, like, I think this is a really good example of just, like, what it is to exist in, like, that double negative. because she's a black woman who's having this voice. And he goes on to say that awards don't matter. And he says this about an award who, for the past 60 years, has only given it, it's given every year, has only given it to 5 black people. So I'm just like, that's easy to say that this award doesn't matter because you, like, you have the Academy, like, bolstering you, no matter, just because you, like, the fact that he can say this is just, like, insane. And people are, like, literally trying to leave, like, we can do this together, we can pull you out of this, you know? and, like, I'm reading this, and it's like, oh, do I, no, do I, I'm just like, no, because, like, my thing that I want to say is, like, the elephant in the room is that, like, of course you don't get it, like, you're the editor-at-large of Wave Press, Wave Books, and for the past 15 years, you've published one black person, and it was a man, and that's a whole other thing. And the black guy that he published, he's a great writer, but he didn't choose it. He partnered with a contest that chose this person, and they had to publish it. So, like, they have never actually chosen a black voice. And it's like, of course you don't get how white people look like this, because you can't see anything other than whiteness in your own aesthetic. And so it's like that notion of only whiteness and mainly the white male experience can be the universal voice, that whenever a person of color says anything, it's just like, oh, that's very interesting from your point of view. It'd be like, I could be making a bowl of soup, and it's just like, tell me how your heritage really impacts what you started. You know, like, everything is kind of, like, seen through that lens, which, like, for me, it's just so interesting because if my name wasn't Hafiza, the things that I would write about, like, it could be white, Asian, anybody, you know, Middle Eastern, Native American. It's just, like, writing about, like, the everyday experiences, but mainly it is white men who have the everyday experiences, which, I mean, that's a thing that I think that I encounter so much, is that, like, I have this specialized voice, and so because people are so hyper aware of it, they're also afraid to engage with anything I say. And so it's just like talking to a brick wall sometimes, or just like you're not really hearing what I'm saying. And so just to close, like Emily said, and y'all don't hear enough poetry, but just to give you an idea of like the things that I write about, that like, you know, if anything, like what you can tell is that I'm a woman. So this is called Girl Scout Handbook. Badge for not telling. Then selling magazines. And then the year all the quarterbacks OD'd, and the year no one really minded. The year of funny uncles followed the year our palms were red. The year of buying earrings implied she would run away. The year of the longest shower and she didn't really mean no coincided. The year no one would forgive her after. We, the broken animals, we, the pleas, popcorn after the abortions. Oh, bear in hibernation, oh, brittle bee, look at her stirring, the way she pulls at her sleeves. Dear year, we had it coming. Dear year, your hands are so red. Dear year of, dear yellow dove of the mind. Dear lover pushing in, we've begun to look like cousins. So black stuff. You know? So for me, that's just always the most fascinating part of, like, because at the end of the day, we have to admit that the feminist movement is a white movement as well. And so, like, how do we intersect that? So that's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Mine's not that funny, but I'll go on anyway. First, I want to thank you for organizing this and asking me to participate alongside so many amazing women. So I guess I'm going to tell you a little about myself and my practice and speak about a project that's kind of like pertinent to our discussion here today. So my name is Jacqueline Mabee, and I work under the name of Failed Projects. And my practice is very much rooted in praxis. I endeavor to create exhibitions and situations and words that draw out the complexities and complicities of digital materiality. So what does that mean? Some of the things I've done include a series of thematic speculative conversations, which I co-organized with Sean Evans, so one of which was around digital subjectivity. Another one was an exhibition proposing the space of a young girl's room as a model of quotidian imaginative resistance,
with a kind of like focus on online girl culture. I did a conference presentation on failure as an anti-capitalist gesture in new media art, which lives as a Tumblr. And I'm just starting research on what will be a multimodal online writing experiment around technological spectrality. But the project that I've worked on that's gotten the most attention is called Art and Feminism, or Art Plus Feminism, which is a campaign to improve coverage of the arts and women on Wikipedia and to encourage female editorship. So in news that I actually still can't really process, myself and my collaborators, Richard Neipel, Dorothy Howard, Laurel Patak, Sean Evans, and Michael Mandenberg, who's here tonight, we were included in Foreign Policy Magazine's list of 100 leading global thinkers, which I will never let my siblings forget. But it was super weird. So there was a conference and a ceremony in D.C. on Monday, and Secretary of State John Kerry spoke and gave this awful speech about how war goes on forever. And I met a scientist who's turning air into water. And they gave us these like Solar Power Globe Awards that just spin slowly forever. So that was great. So I think the reason that the Art and Feminism project has worked and that has gotten the response it has is because it does two things at once. It's both a very like compelling form of activism where, you know, on the day of the edit-a-thon last February at iBeam and around the world, we edited, like, we either improved or created 200 articles, and that's of what we know, you know, it was a volunteer effort, so the record keeping isn't perfect. But, you know, at the end of the day, we had this very concrete thing. But at the same time, it opens a space for more nuanced discussion around representation and digital labor and being a woman online. And I think it's a more inclusive discussion as well, because everyone has some kind of practical experience with Wikipedia. So it's funny to me that this project, of all the things I've done, has sort of gotten the most attention, because it's, in a way, I feel like the most politically neutral thing I've ever done. And it's not really about my investment in Wikipedia as such. Like, you know, we work with editors who have made like a million edits, and they're very much invested in Wikipedia as a thing. But for me, I'm just speaking for me, not my other collaborators, my interest was in making like in a feminist intervention about taking up space as a woman online. So a little background for those of you who don't know, Wikimedia's gender trouble is pretty well documented. In a 2011 survey, the Wikimedia Foundation found that less than 10% of its contributors are female. So the reason for this gender gap, the reasons are up for debate. Some of it is about leisure inequality, that women are more likely to work a second shift when they get home and therefore have less free time. The way that we raise girls, we don't raise them to think they're, you know, authorities on anything. We don't raise them to like take up space in that way. And as well because of the sometimes contentious nature of the Wikipedia's top pages, which is a very nice way to say, like, beta male misogyny. but the practical effect of this disparity is not up for debate. So content is skewed by the lack of female participation. And the example, which I find problematic, but the example that is well known is that an entry on one character from Grand Theft Auto has 500 citations, whereas the entries for like friendship bracelets and Sex and the City are quite short. I don't like that example, but it's a really well known one. Partly this represents an alarming absence in an increasingly important repository of shared knowledge. But also why it's really important, and not everyone understands this, is that Wikipedia is quickly becoming like the content backbone of the internet, that there are a number of different APIs that pull in its content. So absences there matter. They matter. So I think that, you know, so that's why Wikipedia for me has been an important site of contestation, because it allows one to both actively contribute and critique an important part of our digital commons and to fight for a more representative and fair internet. And, you know, as far as like trolling and abuse, I mean, we were ready. I was like crouched and waiting to get doxxed when we started this project. Like, I thought we would just have a horrible response. But we got a lot of press. It was 99% positive. You know, there was something stupid on Campus Reform, which is like a neocon school blog. And then there was like a thread on Reddit
that was actually just so great. Because it was like, feminists plan to edit Wikipedia, misinformation will reign. And just like the like, oh, again, it's like reading those comments and you're like, God, you're just so amazing, keep talking. Because like one guy was like, can we call the boss so they shut this thing down for a day so they can't ruin it? But yeah, so it's been, I mean, maybe it's like a hopeful place to start the discussion, but it's been a sort of, you know, when I get... Because I just get crippling sangries, like sad and angries, like when because of like Armita Sarkeesian and Gamergate, and you know, Nisha Day comes out against Gamer Day and she's doxxed right away. You know, all these forms of online abuse that happen to women, just it's hard not to just get sad and not leave your bed. So participating in this project has been really heartening for me. Yeah, but I would love to hear from everybody else.
Yes, it's open. Please, we give cameras to finish talking. Please, if you have any questions to anyone on this. Just
I don't have a question, but I wanted to say to you that when I go to events like this in a more, more feminist, like, this is like an art space. I assume we're here because we're interested in feminism, but more explicitly feminist space, there usually is a childcare component.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it doesn't take much to have someone volunteer or to hire someone to sit over there with like three children in color.
We actually got a grant for art and feminism, and a big part of the funding is to go for free childcare for as many of the satellites as we can pay for.
And we'd love for that to become a standard component of all.
Well, it is standard in other countries.
It is.
Not in America, where we value life and do absolutely nothing to look after it.
That's one, the second part of that that I find interesting is just to think about how, I mean, I agree with what you said when you say it's very different now and you can assume maybe that the average person now maybe is different from 1970.
The
right?
People in this room.
Yes. Okay.
That's what I'm talking
yes.
about. I'm not talking mm-hmm. about the world. Okay.
But what I think is crazy is that state-sponsored child care was approved by the House and the Senate and vetoed by Nixon, right? So now nothing like that would get through the House and the Senate to be, you know, whatever the president would do with signing or vetoing that bill, but like that's where the conversation was to this, where it got to. So I find like those, it just is crazy that then people don't take that on to, like it, that part of the conversation has kind of evaporated where it was so much a part of the conversation to have gotten through Congress.
Equal pay for equal work evaporated and never came back.
Yeah, the whole conversation is evaporated.
Yeah, the whole conversation
just took everything away.
Evaporated.
It's
I mean,
gone.
That's the thing is that, you know, if you're old and you've been watching this shit go down like I have for 47 years, mm-hmm. right, since I was 17 or 18, you can't help but think that it's only going backwards because it's...
Because it is.
It is.
Is it going backwards or is it more transparent? Because we're talking... from what I got from the whole panel today is that the inception of it was because of... Not necessarily because of Gamergate, but because of women feeling fearful of expressing their ideas on the internet. So one of the first things I started thinking about is that every group, you know, it's like you're talking about your Gothamist piece, you know, all these crazy comments you got on it. Go on World Star Hip Hop one day and just like go through the comments and like the same dudes are there, but instead of being it, you know, gender specific, it's about race. You know, it's because people don't have consequences on the internet. So the ideas that are probably, before the internet ever came to be, the ideas that have been in people's heads have already been there. It's just on the internet they can express them without getting a consequence from them. So I don't know if that's necessarily going backwards, if it's just exposing, which has already been there. for decades.
The thing is, like, if to just to put it in a context, I had an illegal abortion in 1968, and I almost died. Okay? And the doctor who did it, when my friends called to find out where I was, said I had never been there. So I would have been like a disappeared person. 6 months later, my younger sister had an abortion when abortion had just been made legal. And she didn't have any stigma, she didn't have any health problems. You know, it was a, you know, one could really see the difference in a very real way. And I watched a lot of girls have abortions and some girls die. Like, it was a real thing for me, you know. To see what's going on now as state by state by state, you know, and I lived in Maine at one point in the middle 70s, and I was got a job as the social worker for a small town of extremely poor people, and I was able to get the town to pay for abortions for women who had like 3 or 4 children, you know. That's impossible now, you know. And to me, that we're losing and have lost, we have lost the rights over our own bodies is like really is going backwards. It's not just that, well, you know, it didn't used to exist or it always existed, you know. And but somehow people aren't so, it somehow it does, because people with money will always be able to get abortions, because people with money can always get abortions. That's the problem, you know. And there are so many other elements, you know, that feed into this feeling of things going backwards, you know, for someone who's my age, you know.
I just want to say, as a corollary to what you were saying in terms of the consequences and sort of a different
yeah,
element
sure.
online, I mean, one of the, I would say, most upsetting things that happened to me in the past year was, do you remember when there was the young man, I'm forgetting his last name, Elliot, yeah, who shot the women, the sorority girls in California, because he felt that they didn't want to have sex with him, and he made this video ahead of time on YouTube.
Yeah.
I think that another, what happened after that is a friend of mine posted, I hate to use the word Facebook, but that's sort of where the story begins, posted on Facebook that he could have been, had just a few things been different in his life, he might have actually been that shooter. And that his hatred for women as he was growing up, because they didn't love him back and they wouldn't sleep with him, was so great, and his rage and his anger was so great that at times he had considered mass violence. And so I think that there's also this corollary. This story was picked up by Slate, and he was allowed, if you read it, and I this is somebody who is I've known for a very long time and been close to, he basically wrote an apologia, I don't know if that's a real word, for the shooter.
Yeah.
And this was given space. And that even in Facebook, among the people who are our peers, that they were applauding him for his honesty and his openness, which certainly was something, but encouraging him and creating this dialogue around that avoided the entire subject of young men going out and sniper shooting girls.
Yeah.
And was about, well, you know, it's so good that you have come to this place of happiness in your life and that you can recognize, you know, your own problems. And I think that that's a sort of the consequence also in terms of the issue of women in the media and how we're represented, is that there's this corollary too.
I'm going to have to disagree with that, because I think there's a lot of other issues that take place in that case.
Yeah.
Not just gender's issues. There's gun control, there's
certainly
mental illness,
yeah.
Like, there's a whole bunch of different things going on with that.
Certainly.
Rather than it just being, you know, a blank, you know, hatred for women. You know, I mean, I read about it probably a couple of weeks ago, you know, someone in the kids, the shooter's school or high school said, if there was anyone that was going to go and shoot a school, it'd be this kid.
Wow.
There's record of
yeah.
this man's, you know, mental illness. So that's, you know, there are, you know, it's like a collage of different things going on. So I can't just solely say that it had to deal with, like, a hatred for women. I think it had to deal with other things.
Well, I think that, I mean, I don't disagree with you. What I'm talking about is the way I experienced what happened after that with a person that I know who was clearly about hatred, and that he was given what felt like a kind of embrace by others, and indeed space in the media as well to explain his point of view. I don't begrudge him his explanation, but I do begrudge the idea of the shift in away from that discussion, away from the discussion of mental illness and gun control, away from those issues to sort of to empathize with him. I'm glad that he didn't go out and do this, but still he was expressing, even in this article, insane hatred and misogyny, really. So that's what I'm taking issue with in terms of this sort of mirror, I guess, I would say, conversation that happens on the internet, particularly in these events of violence against women. But I think all of exactly what you're saying is there present there, too.
But what was also present in that specific incident was that his statements and his writing around the shootings, if you actually read them, the act was more about his relationship to men in terms of women than his relationship to women.
Still, he shot women. I mean, I see that. I know
yeah.
what you're talking about. But.
But there's a hatred of women, but you can also... But that's a little bit more complicated, which I think you were saying, in that women are seen as a kind of currency.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a specific kind of man affected by that fact.
Mm-hmm. You feel that they're less of a man if they don't have the
yeah.
currency.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For me, honestly, I'm more fearful for international women. For instance, the whole, you know, crisis of women in Honduras.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of times we become so insular about what we're talking about in the feminist discussion, especially in America. I'm going to be really honest, I was sexually assaulted a couple of months ago, and the police were very, you know, helpful, you know? It wasn't a situation where that's been painted for me for so long that, like, they're not going to listen to you. Very helpful with me, you know, trying to you know, find this guy and press charges, but I could imagine in somewhere like Honduras that wouldn't happen. And I feel like a lot of times we don't spend the time to talk about situations that we become so like fixed on our own idea of what's happening here versus what we think is happening here is actually really happening somewhere else. And we should fight for those people more than, you know, just be so, you know. I don't know. I don't necessarily know the word to say, but I sometimes I feel like,
solipsistic.
Yeah. I would say even like kind of painting a fantasy or so sometimes, or painting this sort of fan fiction. That's a good word. You know, of our. I just had a recent incident where, you know, a girl wanted me to delete some guy off of Facebook because she said that he sexually assaulted her. And then all these kind of trigger words, these words that you hear all the time on feminist blogs, like, I'm a survivor and all these things, and these narratives that tend to be sometimes so generic, you know. But I consider myself a survivor as well, but then also I see how that narrative has been exploited for an agenda sometimes. And I feel like it's, you know, there's a lot of fights, like you were talking, you know, reproductive rights, like I totally agree with you. But then there's certain fights that we tend to fixate on so much because they're really, we really can't change, you know? We've changed as much as we can. We have the right to a rape kit, you know. We have the right to a rape kit, you know. And that, to some people, is like not enough, you know. So we tend to fixate on these experiences when the most hard experiences are happening somewhere else sometimes.
But not necessarily. I mean, those, you were lucky in the way you were treated by the police.
Yes.
I was raped 5 times in the East Village before I was 18 years old. And one of the times that I was raped, only once, the second time, I wasn't, like, vaginally or anally raped, right? And I went to the police because there were young women, there were young girls who were living, who played in the hallways of that building. And the person who had attacked me, who I didn't know, I mean, this was someone who, like, followed me into the building and into the apartment because I was stupid enough to leave the door open and not turn on the light. And I wanted to get my coat, and I left the door open, you know, which you should never do, you know. Anyways, he had told me that if I went to the police, that he would come back and kill me. So the girl whose apartment it was told me, you know, oh, you can't, she had heard the whole thing, and she said, you can't go to the police, and I decided to go to the police. And when I had to give the explanation on 5th Street on the second floor where the detectives were, the guy was like, so he didn't rape you? And I'm like, no, he didn't rape me. And he's like, hey, Joe, look at this. You ever seen anything so fine, so young, so tender? He didn't even rape her. Poor guy, what a freak. You know, I mean, this kind of thing.
What year was this, though?
That was 1968, but I mean, your story, I'm just going to say, I know, just like I, I can't hear what you're saying.
I'm confused about your question, why are you asking what year? For
a year, yeah, definitely, I mean.
No, I mean, because I'm just bringing up something. I mean, we could say, it's not 1970, that's what I said before. I'm just bringing up something personal to me, of an experience I had. I also am very involved with a lot of people in Mexico about Las Desaparecidas, the women who are disappearing, you know, from the border towns and are being murdered. I mean, there's currently also, many people know, 23 students who have, student teachers who have disappeared.
43.
43 now, okay. I'm sorry, my numbers are going. But the world's a horrible place, filled with horrible people. This is a reality, and horrible things that are so hard to change, you know? And I just find that people are now, like, so many people are activists, and it's become an identity. It's not what somebody does anymore. It's an identity, you know, that they have. You know, which I always say, you know, calling yourself an activist is like calling yourself a saint, that an activist is what your community calls you after decades of service. But I just feel like that it's so hard to get action from people. There's so little action, you know? And I think that, you know, a lot of the people in this room are young, you know? And you're gonna live, and you're gonna go through the different stages of life. And biology will drop you, as it drops us all. That's a real thing, it happens. And everyone will experience many things as you go through your life. And we're living in a period right now that's virtual in almost every sense, because it's so hard. Like, just like me being here, if this was a male panel, and everybody, all things being equal, everybody on the panel was in their 20s and early 30s, and if Burroughs was here, and he was twice the age of the other people on the panel, not one person in this room would be hating the person who was older, who was talking whenever they felt like it, when they felt something to contribute. And it's a problem with women, that women, when women contribute, they're seen as controlling, you know? And I just came from a 4-day conference, art conference, National Performance Network, and one of the women who was there brought up childcare because they're, you know, none of the women who had children could bring their children to this 4-day conference. You know, whereas in Europe, that's a standard, you know? It's a standard at conferences to have childcare. But the thing of women betraying women in who claim to be feminists, that's standard all over the world. Because, you know, as soon as, you know, I came here, you know, because Katya asked me to come here. I'm not getting paid. I'm 64 years old. I don't get paid a lot to do things. And I do things because I want to experience other people. I want to experience, like tonight, like people were calling me today and going, what the fuck are you doing that for? You know? And it's an interesting conundrum, we might say, you know? Because while people want to talk about what's not working with feminism from outside, nobody wants to talk about what's not happening with it from inside. And I think that that is the only place that we can start, that we are really supporting each other and understand, because it's a really curious thing that women seem to hate strong women. You know, it's so unhelpful. Because men already hate strong women, not all men, but most men, you know, hate strong women. And then you have, you know, when I was 17, I was involved with, I used to do the hotline on 6th Street, where all those Indian restaurants are now, for the Yippie hotline, right? And Abby Hoffman gave the space, they had two storefronts, gave the other space to a woman named Robin Morgan, who was starting Witch, right? I think a lot of you know who Robin Morgan is, very famous feminist. And Robin was probably 10 or 12 years older than me. And she wanted me in this group. And I went to one of the first meetings. And they were talking about how they didn't want to be seen as housewives. And they, you know, and I was like listening to this. And I'm from an immigrant working class Southern Italian immigrant family where nobody in my family's ever read a book. And my mother had to work 70 hours a week in a sweatshop. And I'm in this meeting and I said, you know what? My mother would have loved to be a housewife. And I recognized right away and I said to them in these words, I said, this is just a tea party for the wives of leftist political pigs, which they all were at that time. They all had boyfriends who were the kind of leaders of the left. And guess what? Robin Morgan didn't get mad at me because I was 17 and she was like 27 or 28 and she wanted my approval, you know, because the way older people always want the approval of the young, you know. So I have like a long history with this, you know, and feminism for me has always been a necessity. It's not a concept. It's not like some kind of idea. It's not a theory. It's like a life or death need, you know? And I don't have a lot of illusions, you know, because I live it. I live it all the time. There's a lot of support that I have never gotten from men in the art world. But as I was saying to Juliana, right? I was saying to Juliana earlier, there's a big difference between the art world and the art market. They're not the same thing, you know, and that's a very important distinction because the art world goes on and on, and if you're an artist, you make art, and you make art because you want to, and it's not a profession. Many of you have been lied to and told that it's a profession. It is not a profession. Art is a vocation. And you may never make any money, you know, and you may never get any support, you know. And I've had to watch for many years people whose work was inferior to me get passed forward. But you know what? At the end of the day, it's about the only success that exists is artistic success, you know? And that goes whether women are supporting you or men are supporting you or not.
I just appreciate what you're saying, but I think it's also very dangerous to dismiss young people.
I'm not dismissing young
saying,
people.
But
please tell me how you see that.
No, I don't mean dismissing, but to tell us that, because you're saying we're not as engage or don't understand that we're saying we're activists.
I just want to say this, okay? There are different periods in history, you know, and there's a gentrification that happens to neighborhoods, and there's a gentrification that happens to ideas. And the ideas around gentrification, the gentrification around ideas like activism, you know, I mean, I was asked to be on a panel last year about anger and activism, and I went to the panel thinking it was about the employment of anger in activism. Turned out that the people on the panel were angry because they felt burnt out. And I said, you know, all the people that I long have admired, and there have been amazing people in this neighborhood that I've known for like close to 50 years who were real incredible activists, they were never burnt out because it wasn't about them. It was about the community they served. So it's a really dicey thing, you know. We're all tethered to the values of the generation we come of age in. Yeah. Nobody's immune from that. I come of age in an era where you earned people's respect, and you had to earn it. Wait, let me just finish the sentence and you can say this. The era now is an era of entitlement. Whether you like it or not, it is, it exists. So I often get called on that I'm like talking down to young people or not respecting young people. The fact I'm here is me showing my respect, you know? And I don't, you know, if we're not on this panel and we're drinking coffee, you and I are exactly the same. But there's no way, you know, that anybody's theory is gonna beat my lived experience. And that's why I think Katya brought me here.
Okay, so I think we have different lived...
No, it's okay. Go and then you go.
I think
she's going to talk first, and then you're going
to
talk.
I'm saying, I think that like that we all have different lived experiences that can apply to different things. Like, I'm of a generation where I know 200 young black people who organized, took a bus down to Ferguson to protest and support,
right.
You know? So I think that activism is happening in different communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think... I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I think we need to be careful about how we apply the statements to make sure we're not doing like a blanket.
Yeah, but
statement.
Wouldn't you? I mean, of course there are young people doing tremendous activism, but there are fucking, 100,000 people who are self-identified as artist activists in fucking Brooklyn, and when 87-year-old Judith Malina, who is one of the greatest artists who created so much of what is considered the actual counterculture, was being evicted out of her fucking apartment, we couldn't get one person to come over there. So I'm not saying that there aren't people doing stuff, but for the majority of people, hitting like on Facebook is not activism. Sitting in your house or drinking in a cafe or a bar and talking about the problems of the world, that's not activism.
So what's the solution?
Well, conversations like this where we start to define some terms.
We haven't defined any terms.
What do you mean I haven't defined any terms?
Except straight my...
What?
Wait. Someone wants to speak
back. Yeah.
I kind of have a problem with the way that the dialogue is going. I feel like you're talking about like other people being entitled, but it's sort
of... Oh, my God.
I mean this with no offense, but it just sort of feels like you're kind of hijacking the conversation using your history, which I think is important to talk about this as a... very real thing, but kind of not allowing all these other voices are in the room to interact into what you want to talk about.
When people want to speak, I'm sure they will.
No, I mean, they are, but I just feel like you took it for a second, but I don't know, I gathered this, I thought you felt a little, like, confronted with people, like, and... their youth and like youth.
Somebody paying you to orchestrate this, girl? Somebody paying you to orchestrate some kind of thing about me?
Yeah,
you too. No, you
too.
What is it about you two? What's your trip about me that's so...
What if you were a man who said that to them?
Huh?
What if you were a man?
I can say anything. Come on, I'm like, what, did I say girls?
No, I mean like attack.
No, I'm just curious. I'm curious. I am wildly curious because I am direct. Okay? I'm direct. So I'm asking...
Fine.
I'm just curious why you two girls have this trip. And I said to Katya when I came here, I said, you know what? I just came from 4 days of workshops where...
See, you're doing it. You turned it on by yourself again. Like, you know,
yes. All right. So I'm talking from my own position.
No, but I mean, there's only so many times that you can, like, take whatever's going on and trying to get something proactive, but you're turning it on by your history. There's a certain level of, like a lesson in a story about what you've been through, which we have, and I admire a lot of it. But you're kind of just trying to, like, so I was here and you're shutting everything down. Like, you didn't even, you accused me of getting paid to, like,
I wasn't talking to you.
Not you.
I was talking to these two girls.
It doesn't matter who you were talking to, you didn't think you were being paid to speak.
It was kind of a joke, but I mean, it's so dynamic. No, the dislike, the distaste is very dynamic, so, you know.
I do have a resting bitch.
It's not
I have a resting bitch face. What does that mean? What's that mean, hon? What's that mean, hon? We talking about a little like sexism here, a little can't kind of take it, like Penny Arcade's so mean. Oh my god, I went to this thing and I can't believe she was on the panel and then she just kept talking. I don't know why she just kept talking.
No, what I would say is I'll just say that maybe in the organization of the panel itself, there wasn't a consideration for the listener.
I think there was, though.
Yeah.
She's a woman who has a ton of experience, and I think we're not respecting her.
Why do you feel that way? Why was that?
And I feel like we talk about, like, war within feminism, and I feel like that's what happened.
This is the shit.
How would you feel about, like, you know, I think there are a lot of black people who, like, would complain that, like, white activists never considered, like, the black movement. And so, I mean, and, like, activists of your age, so how do you bring that into the conversation? Or the fact that, like, how many people here are posting on Facebook about Ferguson? And, right, and so we say that Facebook activism doesn't matter, but, like, when I go to my feed and I see only the black people who didn't talk about, like, that to me is
That remark was specifically about people who just hit like and nothing else. But the thing is that one of the things that's really broken down since the 60s was coalition. And this is a powerfully huge problem that we have no coalition. I mean, I try to tell young queers who want to go on and on and on about Stonewall that the Black Panthers were at Stonewall. The up against the wall motherfuckers, the anarchist groups were, I mean, people want to act like Stonewall was made up of white lawyers, you know what I mean? And it wasn't. It was, sorry. if I don't smoke a cigarette at least once an hour, this bad thing happens. But you know, there was this incredibly powerful coalition that is complete.
How many have heard of Stonewall in this room?
Huh?
What? How many have heard of Stonewall in this room? Just
oh, they know Stonewall. They know all that stuff. But you know what I mean? Like, this is something that's completely hidden from the conversation, let's say in queer circles, which is why I bring it up. But I really feel that, you know, the lack of coalition, that there's all these small, this theoretical thing and the way people are being taught now. You know, people used to go to college to learn how to think, and now they go to college to learn what to think. And a lot of people come out of school with a sensor buried in their forehead where they scan for homophobia, they scan for racism, they scan for sexism, and they always find it, you know? So, I mean, to me, it's like these conversations would hopefully break down things, you know what I mean? That to break down, at least to say, we're living in a monogenerational era. You know, when I was coming up, I didn't have to have an opinion when I was 27. I wasn't expected to have an integrated point of view at 27. It was seen then that you grew. The developmental arc was like 18 to 40. And a young Turk thinker was somebody who was 47, not 27. you know? So it creates a very big problem if the generational more has changed to where most of you don't know 64, you don't have 64-year-old people in your lives. You know what I mean? Unless it's your grandmother.
My mom is actually.
The one.
Listen, I'm incredibly proud to be 64 years old because I spent the 80s burying my friends who never got to be 30, never got to be 40, never got to be 50.
Well, you said there was like this extreme confusion of this generation, and maybe that's why that we. Many of these groups or queer groups are like or a reactionary group. No, I wouldn't say these groups are reactionary, but these like responses to rhetoric are the only thing that anger them to some sort of thing, you know, because it's become such a confusing time for us. So, you know, you talk about these coalitions coming together, you know, she spoke about Ferguson, you know.
Right.
To me, this is such a messed up perspective. Even being a black woman, I look at Ferguson in such a passive way. Is it because I'm not a knowledgeable person? No, it's because I might be conditioned to be passive on situations like this. You know, because when we are taught in school about these, you know, the civil rights movement and the feminist movement, they're so visceral. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't feel visceral anymore. It just feels so passive. So maybe because these feel so passive to us, or not everyone, but maybe to me, which I think a lot of people do, we become so, you know, tied to rhetoric because that's the only concrete thing that we can hold on to. And I think
she'd
all.
Like to say something.
Yeah. I totally hear what you're saying, honey, but I think that lately, I feel like in the past year, I've been privy to a lot of conversations both online and you know in person about these very issues, but like grappling with how do we create coalitions, how do we make feminism more inclusive, how do we give space for the voices, for everyone's voice within feminism, how do we make it a like site for production of difference. So I feel that, you know, that it's not, I haven't abandoned all hope yet. I think that you see these coalitions happening. I mean, that was another really heartening thing about when we did the edit-a-thon last year, that literally no event I have organized has been so diverse when it comes to race, age, I mean, from like infants to like, we had 74-year-olds editing for the first time.
Right.
And it wasn't just art world people, which made me so happy. that you see that, you know, if you create spaces that are open and enable people to have their own agency, that those coalitions can form.
How can you create those agencies? I mean, that was interesting. We're talking about action, and you said that feminism is very white, and we all go, but like, I am curious. Feminism, it sounds weird, because it's very new to me. I'm just learning more and more about it. But I feel like it is kind of the cyclical question of like, it's like, it is, we have the white male supremacist, but then we don't, and we're talking about the inner circle, but we all just nod, and it's hard for me to like, I mean, I'm curious, like you said, there was a success in that. So how do you create those kind of environments where it is more inclusive? And I know that's difficult because we're also in New York City, which is also its own bubble within itself.
Yeah.
When we're talking about other places in the world where like the idea of like, women and men being equal is absurd because it's apples and oranges. But I mean, it might be good to be specific in this situation right now where we are, and like how do you be more inclusive in feminism?
Sorry. You go.
So I think that's a really good question, and I think I hear that question asked a lot at things like this, and I think the answer is so simple that it's like you have to do work.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't just happen. Like, you have to work. You have to first go out there and do your research and look at people who have done that. Look at our foremothers. Look at people who have created those spaces and learn about them and put in that effort. And you have to take some risks. You have to be patient also. It's not like you could make a little Facebook and then have like this amazing thing just happen. happen.
Yeah.
You know, you have to build relationships with people. You have to exit your comfort zone. You have to.
And there has to be forgiveness and acceptance of other people too in trying this process.
And willingness that you're gonna fuck up.
Yeah.
And you're gonna trust that other people are gonna still give you another chance.
Yeah.
That you,
because
you
you're
can,
working
you
in good
can work through it. I mean, there's some fuck-ups that might be, like, so bad.
You have to actively look for these people, I think.
Yeah.
So, like, you just get, like,
not
mean,
easy solution.
Just that people think people of color are hiding, you know, like, but they're not, you know. So you're just like, well, I just couldn't find anybody. I guess you could, you know. Or, like, you just, like, go to a reading, there's just a bunch of straight white guys. Not there's anything wrong with that. But, like, yeah, like, but it's just, like, huh, someone didn't try today.
Yeah.
But you have to, and that's it. And I have to say one thing, just to a point that came up earlier, which I'm sure a lot of people already are thinking, and that's why, like, I feel like if it doesn't get said, I might explode. I've done activism work in New York City for a decade around sexual violence, and it is very rare that people have a positive experience.
Yeah.
Yes.
Today,
yes,
in this
that.
Moment. So,
well,
that, so
I'll
that's
say
awesome
that.
That you did, because sometimes
no, it's I'm a black woman who lives in Harlem. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the number one thing. I'm a black, and the fact that I had a positive experience
awesome.
With police, and I also was drunk when that experience happened,
mm-hmm.
to me was shocking.
Yeah,
I was shocked like everyone else in this room. The fact that I was given the ability to a rape kit, I was shocked like everyone else in this room.
They all watched Law and Order, so they know what happened.
And I'm not trying to diminish any experience. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that a lot of times, what I've noticed within feminist circles, when we tend to speak about sexual assault and rape, it becomes a conversation that it becomes an agenda more than actual experiences and people speaking about their experiences. That's all I was saying. I wasn't trying to diminish anyone's experience. I wasn't trying to make anyone feel like I was,
yeah.
was making them feel like I wasn't doing anything like that. I was just saying there's
yeah.
a certain rhetoric that happens that kind of makes me feel a bit awkward as someone who has experienced it, and it kind of makes it feel cheap on a certain level sometimes. I mean,
well, I think that what you're saying, I really kind of get what you're saying right there, because there's so much shame around sexual attack and sexual abuse, and people don't talk about it, you know? And I've always said, you know, I was never a victim, I was always a target, you know? And I think that what happens, like when you started talking about your experience, it triggered me to want to, I mean, I don't believe in safe spaces, but I felt that in this space, I don't like that, I don't believe in it, because there is never a safe space for me. But I felt like I could say what happened to me, you know, gave me a chance to verbalize that it happened to me, which there could be somebody in this room who needed to hear me say, hey, I was raped 5 times before I was 18, and look, you know, I'm fabulous, I'm 64, my life doesn't suck. You know what I mean? So I just want to say that could trigger people to just start jumping up and saying, feeling the need to express something about themselves in that way. This girl with the purple scarf's been waiting to speak.
Yeah, I have to leave soon, but I just, I mean, I wasn't sure actually if I was in the right space, but because it was called media. And I've been doing media, like photography and filming of a lot of protests and actions
mm-hmm.
for at least 4 years now. And, you know, trying to make a living at it, and it's really, you know, sort of difficult. I have always been passionate about, you know, truth and justice, and, you know, just before the Occupy movement, you know, came out, I kind of, you know, started doing it, and I just picked up a camera and just, you know, was filming and taking pictures, and, you know, since then, I go to a lot of events, interview people, and have a radio show on an online radio show, but it's, you know, it's going pretty well. I'm gonna have like really good guests, and I kind of sort of don't know what direction like my words are going in now. But as far as like, you know, feminism and things like that,
I'm sorry.
I think the Cyril podcast actually started playing. We'll talk about it later. All right, sorry.
You know, just a lot of the actions and things that I go to, of course, it's all about, like, you know, ending capitalism. And, like, I've been talking about this stuff for decades. I'm not as old as you, but for decades I've been trying to get people, like, I didn't know about the Fed, I didn't know about Wall Street decades ago, but I knew in my immediate surroundings. I mean, I heard mention, you know, like, the people that they know, like, don't read books. I mean, I didn't, you know, more than anything in the world, I didn't want to turn out to be like the people that I was surrounded by when I was growing up. It was just like the last thing that I wanted to be like, you know, because it was just like suppression. It was just, you know, just get a job, and it was literally like a crime to be smart. So anyway, when the Occupy thing happened, I was like, oh my God, like, finally, what took it so long? And so anyway, again, like, I'm kind of like, don't really have a sort of point of what I'm trying to say, but
You're breathing out, you know, with words, which is totally valid.
I mean, I have, like, a lot to say, and, like, there's so much in my mind. So, you know, I'll just end up going in too many different directions. So,
I think what's happening right now, actually, is pretty incredible. I mean, I think, I know that you've talked about sort of consideration about the way the discussion has gone, and some people feel that some people have dominated or that there's not listening going on, but I actually sort of hear people revealing things that are very personal that I don't think necessarily happen in spaces in New York, and sort of putting down a lot of their guard about whatever their prejudices are or how they view the world or their pretensions, and sort of, you know, kind of trying to sort of do what you're talking about, which is build a coalition, which starts with, as you said, empathy. I don't think it has to be in terms of activism. I don't think that means that you can't have anger at people and you can't disagree with them and you can't think that they're, like, you know, off their fucking rocker or whatever it is. But it does mean that you see them as human beings and not as ideas or representatives or slogans or symbols. I actually think what you're saying, even though you're like, I don't have my words, is very beautiful. I mean, you know, so...
Well, also, Havisa brought this up too, but in terms of, in my experience, people get active when it involves them, you know? When something involves them. I was doing pirate radio in the 90s in this neighborhood during the... I was doing housing activism. I took 2 years off of touring to just do straight-ahead housing activism. And I had a friend, still a friend of mine. She's about 5 years younger than me. And I was trying to get her to go to these demonstrations that we were having where they were shutting down the squats. And I was trying to get her to go to these demonstrations. And she said, man, I'm not going to those. She goes, the police hit you in the head. Well, one day she came home and found out that her apartment house on the Lower East Side, that the landlord was bringing in the building department and was going to throw them all, condemn the building and throw them all out. She got radicalized overnight. Yeah. Overnight. My longtime collaborator, Steve, who I mentioned earlier from Iowa, he was always saying, Penny, you're too far left, you're too far left, you know, you gotta rein it in, you gotta rein it in. And then when they tore down the building on the corner of Stanton Street and Clinton Street, which was done by the city of New York overnight, they brought on a Friday night, Saturday morning, they brought in, and this is stuff that, you know, a lot of you guys weren't around for, but they had fucking tanks, all right? Tanks in the streets of the Lower East Side. And the housing department owned those tanks. And they tore down the building overnight. And Steve got radicalized overnight because he was a former architect.
And he knew that that building didn't have to come down. And if it had been on Park Avenue, they would have put everybody in a hotel and, you know, treated them beautifully. So the question is, how do we extend ideas to people before they have to have their own personal experience of it? I had black hair till I was 55 years old, and I looked completely Latina. And because of the color of my skin and the color of my eyes, that when I went blonde when I was 55, all of a sudden, for the first time in my life, I looked white. Now, I had never been considered white my entire life. And it was a real super shock when I had to go from being followed around in supermarkets and pharmacies and being treated like shit all the time because I was a woman and because I didn't look white, not getting parts in movies because I didn't look white, all those things that would occur to me from the age of 30 to 55. And then suddenly, all of a sudden, you know, when I was at a class at NYU and I said to the kids, I started writing my own work because I couldn't get any jobs because, you know, I didn't look white. And usually all the black, Latino, and Asian kids would all be sitting there going, and they were all like this. And I asked them why they were looking at me. Like, they went, you look white. You look real white. So, you know, even in your own life, you can go, you don't even know what can happen. You know, I mean, you can, a lot of things can happen over a 30-year period. But, like, something like this shouldn't end with just one session. Do you know what I mean? Because you can't build on it. All people can say is, oh, I had a really good time. Oh, it really sucked. Oh, that fucking girl, Penny Arcade's a bitch. You know, do you know what I mean? Like, if it doesn't keep moving, like, what, you know, it's about what can we build on. And I bet a lot of people are here also because, you know, the market has crept into everything now. You know, that girl was saying that, you know, she was, you know, doing activist photography and she wanted to earn a living, you know, which anybody, you know, my age would go, really? Like, really? You know? But there's that expectation among younger people that they will get paid for work, even for radical political work, you know? So there's a lot of conversations that I think that are connected with what this panel was about, you know, that could keep going. And I, for one, I'd come back.
Connected to what you said and what we've been talking about and what we've been doing and the question that she asked and now she's gone about like how do you do it, that I don't know if you know this, Penny, but utopia translates as no place. So I started saying your utopia is no place, it is a process.
Mm-hmm.
It's how do we do this? I think that the first and most important privilege to critique and dismantle is your own.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we build coalitions? It's by looking around and recognizing that, you know, an upper middle class white girl from Canada occasionally has to shut the fuck up and give space to women who are older than her, women of color. You know, I think that was the whole thing with Not All Men, that totally missing the point of Yes All Women was to give a space to listen to women and shut the fuck up.
I wanted to add to what you said earlier, Gina, right?
Mm-hmm.
I work for a female artist. She's a sculptor, painter. She has installation, and she has an amazing 3-year-old son. But she's been getting shafted from studio visits, being shown at the Whitney. Like, once she says the word, I have a child, it's like, you know, get away from me. Which in turn puts me in a predicament because she's like, we have a great working relationship,
mm-hmm.
and she's like, I can't support you. I had to start selling her tools so she could pay me so I could pay my rent.
Oh, God.
And so there's this vicious cycle that I think that my three friends and I, we talk about too, about, well, being shafted just being a female, but also the me knock down other girls to get my like stride first to be that stronger female, but like knocking down my teammates on the way. And I feel like that's just been buzzing in my head that I currently experience every day. Like, I've worked for installers that I worked, like, did favors for that were men collectors, male collectors. And not only, like, from condescending comments, but to getting paid. I mean, I worked 2 to 9, and he gave me a $50 check.
No.
So, I think that...
Just pause with that.
So, I'm just saying that I've really... Like, everything that everyone's saying is just... There's so much buzz that's happening right now inside me that I feel as though I was so excited that I ditched this other lecture when they told me about this. I was like, oh, like, it's like, it feels kind of like I have a I feel good, like it's like a space to say something.
When we don't help each other, it's self-defeating.
Yeah. I think that's also, I mean, I know that in my genre of performance, one of the topics that's really current and that I think does, like Penny touched on it and you touched on it, needs to be discussed, is female-on-female violence. And that's something that's happening. I mean, there are all sorts of incidents that have been discussed in the press. There are all sorts of incidents where, you know, the structure that sort of I've heard proposed that women, in order to get into major institutions, mm-hmm. artistic, visual institutions, or specifically what I'm talking about, I imagine, I don't know how it is in poetry or writing, mm-hmm. But have to be parasites off of each other. So the piece that I did has often been talked about as a parasite with Marina, as a parasitic performance where there has to be, because there are so few women in positions of authority or decision-making, that they have to sort of suck off of each other, and that creates a feeling of violence and hostility. And so I think that is something, in terms of specifically talking about feminism in the art world, that is indicative of other types of violence that is, and those fights get, I mean, I don't want to mention people's names, but like, those mm-hmm. fights can get, I mean, there are a couple notorious situations around rape and bodies, and they can get very violent. And I think that this idea that you're talking about teammates versus this sort of violent catfighting, cutthroat sort of thing, is a very important discussion to have sometime, you know.
When I think of that, I think of it in it from a different way. It's not necessarily women. I understand that analogy with women as kind of parasites of each other, to like climb up each other in a sense. But I often think of it as related to, okay, so if we're going to talk about power structure and power hierarchies, there's like privilege that is guarded, let's say, by straight white men. Sorry. and then it's like, okay, we'll like loosen that boundary a little bit to let other people in. You know, and so it's like, okay, well, like, white women can, like, act like white men because they can, like, wear power suits and lean in and, like, I'll be let in that circle a little bit, but you can't let in too many other people. It's like, I'm trying to share in that privilege. I'm trying to get that circumference, like, just big enough to include me, too, as opposed to kind of challenging the system that would only distribute, you know, opportunity or justice or dignity to certain people within those groups.
You know,
so, like, that's hard. But also what's hard is then being able to say, I had an experience with a structure that supports that, that wasn't horrible, and maybe you could use part of that practically, or there are, like, policy solutions. Like, nobody who is, like, not nobody, but, like, there's this, like, leftist or, like, you know, progressive, maybe progressive is not right, so, like, leftist or, like, radical, like, pushback against the idea that, like, there are some structures in place that are okay, or, like, can be useful. Like, the whole idea that, like, feeling awkward maybe about saying, I actually had an okay experience with the police where they did the job that they were supposed to do. Like, you know, so it's like those two things at once, you know, because
you are working with the, you know, we're working with what we've got, and so there are ways that you can instrumentalize what's there, but then only thinking of it in terms of that just means the circle still has to stay pretty small, so that if you're only looking out for yourself, having access to like those functioning policies or structures.
There's some interesting like tension nuance happening in this conversation right now about women relating to women. There's something that you mentioned earlier that really struck me. You said that as a woman of color, whatever you express in a certain, in some sense, is kind of precious because of your position of you are free to engage in it because of where you're speaking from and like wanting distance from it. And I kind of feel a similar fear of expressing when I might have a disagreement with another woman, for example. And it's something where I think the fun tension is on one end. We're recognizing there's a lot of violence done from women to other women. And in fact, it can be the most pernicious violence of women. It can be what might be like the least constructive thing to actually be able to change, because we can't even organize it ourselves. And then at the same time, to give context to my position, like I am a writer, I have written criticism, and I don't feel comfortable writing a critique of a work done by another female artist that's actually critical. And there's the one reason I can frame it is, and I've actually had this conversation in this space in like different classes that we've been discussing more by women, and I want to critique it, but then the response is, oh, you can't push against, or you can't, how to say it, I never want to silence another woman or take away from her message. But then at the same time, am I not then supposed to actually address it?
You can disagree with love.
I mean, like, my feminism includes disagreement.
We can disagree respectfully.
To articulate in a way, I'm kind of wondering what sense can we both acknowledge that violence, but that women commit violence to women by also allowing space to speak. You know, by also allowing spaces to say, for example, I had a good time, the cops treated me well, or I might really respect your work, but frankly, I don't really like, you know, I have a valid critique of it. And I just feel like that tension is actually really interesting. And I for example, won't write anything, a negative critique about a female artist. It's a shame, because I feel like as women, we should be the ones to be critiquing each other. Honestly and earnestly.
Well, maybe you need to start a feminist journal where you can feel.
Yes, but I did in college.
Oh, so there you go.
And that was, by the way, a non-sponsored message. I will not pay.
Well, I think that's like a question. Not sorry.
Oh, I have a question for you, and many people here. How do you understand the difference between inclusiveness and universality? Because in this discussion, the notion of inclusiveness has been valorized, but the notion of a universal perspective mm-hmm. has been posited as something that should be avoided at all costs.
I don't think that a universal perspective should be avoided. I think that in society, only certain people get to have a universal perspective. Like, they're the only people who can experience anything rationally. Like, women are just being hysterical. Like, black people are angry. Asian people are studying. You know, just like, stereotypes that we have, like, limits how human we can be. Like, we clearly can't have that breadth of emotion over this experience. So I think, like, that's the problem. And I think, in terms of inclusivity, there's, Michelle Martin, this journalist, had this show on NPR, and she, in terms of inclusivity, she says, just look around to each room to see who's not there, and your job is to go get them the next time. That's how you include. Like, we can all look around the room and be like, there's certain people who aren't here. You know, like, where are those people? And that's how you change that. But to your point of, I think, women and violence, I think one of the things we end up doing as women is talking about, like, that person was a bitch, you know? Or, like, we just talk about the violence, we don't deconstruct it. Why do we have to treat each other like this? Because, like, at the end of the day, just like, you know, people of color can internalize racism, women, like, internalize misogyny. And you said
truly.
That, like, patriarchy
yeah.
is a gender. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's
yeah.
the same thing. Like,
yeah.
Because, like, you know, there's that saying that the great trick the devil ever pulled was convincing people he didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we do when we, like, put patriarchy on each other. And then in terms of, like, criticism, I think, like, that's, like, another trick of patriarchy. I was thinking of criticism that, like, criticism is bad when, like, someone is just attacking someone versus asking questions that pushes someone to think. Because with poetry, like, you know, for a poetry workshop or for your MFA, it's like 3 years of criticism. Like, you bring a poem about, like, the most personal thing you've ever felt, and 18 people rip it apart, you know?
Yeah.
But they do it in a way to be, like, what you're doing is good, but I think you can be better, and we're going to get better together.
Right.
So I think it's, like, the approach, like, just, like, not just have, like, a bad criticism, like, oh, that was terrible. But, like, you know, this Facebook thread, like, everybody here is, like, respectfully critiquing this man for 26 pages, you know? Like,
yeah.
At some point, someone should have been like, fuck you.
Yeah.
everyone's just, like, on board. So I think it's, like, that attitude, just, like, I guess, like, critiquing my man.
I think that the other thing I just want to say very briefly that I think you touched on, and I think that was touched on earlier, is when you were talking about your backyard, when you were talking about your naked therapy project, is that what there's an element of being a woman, which is being a feminist, which is, you know, standing up for each other and showing solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also being a human. And the rights that you want to have as a human, you want to be able to say, you know, just because I'm a fellow woman doesn't mean that I have to like or coddle or love or support what you do. I'm an individual as well. And I think in your project, one of the things that all of you have talked about is sort of being able to own one's sexuality,
mm-hmm.
and being able to say that I'm a sexual creature without that being an invitation, without that being a provocation,
right.
without that being something that's dangerous or frightening, and I think particularly the invitation part. And so those are things that are about being a human. And I don't think that I'm not going to say anything about straight white men because I'm not one and I don't know. But all I can say is that as a woman, I don't feel that I am able to fully exercise what I believe are human rights. And my humanity because of fear, because of all of these different things. I agree with you also that that's something I know that I'm incredibly privileged to be able to exercise human rights in this time and place in this country more than other people and other women and other people and other women around the world. But my experience is limited by feeling, you know, hemmed in by these things that are sometimes, I think, because we haven't progressed to the point where women have equality. So that's a sort of balance. I think you were talking about that too in terms of, like, the experience of being African-American woman considered precious. And what are those, and exactly what you're talking about in this debate, right? Like, or I don't know if you call it debate, this sort of,
no,
you know,
no,
thing, right? but what is your allegiance, right? And what are your responsibilities as a member of a group, whether you identify that or not?
Yeah.
And what are your sort of responsibilities to yourself and as a human, as an individual? And how do those things kind of, where do they meet? Where do they? I don't know.
To what you were saying and to what Juliana was saying, you know, the world has always been about sex and power and who's at the top of the sexual batting order. So, you know, somebody who identifies or is known as a mother, this, like, immediately knocks, like, 80% of people out of interest with you, you know, and these are real things. I mean, there's things that are in the world that you're not going to get rid of human nature. Human nature is what it is. It's how do we go around, you know, how can we, in our relationships with the
Like I always say that you can't change the world, you know? You can only change the world around you. And if everybody changed the world around themselves, then little by little, we expand these parameters, you know? We get more space. But it's so funny for me, too, because, you know, everything's so... political correctness is so entrenched in the culture, you know? And you just see, you can just see the way it manifests, and it's kind of funny to me, you know? But I just wanted to, you know, just say that, like somebody said to me the other day, where when the National Performance Network was run completely by men, which was 30 years ago, I was never included, my work was never promoted, so I didn't tour all over America like my work deserved to do. 15 years ago, unbeknownst to me, it got taken over by women, many of whom I just met at this conference. And I said, well, how did that happen? And they said, oh, you know, men get heart attacks.
Men die first.
And then it actually happened. And this wonderful woman, there were so many powerful women there who were so remarkable and who knew they'd known my work for 25 years, and they weren't in a position to help me. And one of them actually said to me, you're not crazy. This did happen to you. You were marginalized. You know, this happened to you, and all of us know the value of your work. And that was an incredibly liberating experience for me to have that support from women. And I also want to say there's also gay white men who are as oppressive with the patriarchy as straight white men. Just wanted to throw that in. Oh, Penny Arcade always throwing something in.
I guess we will finish up. I just want to say...
But you have the Facebook page.
Yeah, I do have
a Facebook page. Well, you have the Facebook page for this event, and if people wanted to write in...
We can make nasty comments.
Yeah.
Or team up and do that.
You know, if people had wanted to say things, or if people think of things that they wanted to say later, which... happens to a lot of us, you know, that they come up, well, gee, I wish I'd said that, or, you know what I mean, that people could feel free to write in there, and then, in a way, that would be a way of keeping the conversation going.
You can, and we will continue doing this as well. There's always more to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
You can stay and talk, but
I know.
But I'd like to say, in regards to personal versus universal, I have asked everybody to talk from their personal experience and from, because personal is universal. That's where I will end. Thank you very much for coming.